need it.
Okay.
Not cheap.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. Thank you for your patience as we figure out our own order. We're going to flip things around a little bit based on the level of interest in people's testimony. So we're going to open up first a hearing on House Bill 2225. Then we will go to 2267 and then finally to 2453. So we're switching the order a little bit. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2225. Troy, do you want to give us a summary? And Mr. Director, if you'd like to join us, we'd appreciate your thoughts too. Troy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2225 relating to Oregon Business Retention and Expansion Program removes sunset from Oregon Business Retention and Expansion Program, allows Oregon Business Development Department to transfer monies from Strategic Reserve Fund to Oregon Business Retention and Expansion Program Fund for purpose of making loans.
Thank you, Troy. You are the only one who has signed up, so we wanted to give you a chance to enlighten us on this bill and then send you on your way.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tim McCabe. I'm director of the Oregon Business Development Department. I'm here in support of the bill. The reason being, this program was initiated last session. It's been used twice now. The first one was for Salesforce, who just this morning announced their new location in Hillsboro. So that's 200 new jobs that have come to the state that pay 150% of the average wage in the state. And as you probably all saw last week, Oracle, this is an existing Oregon company, chose to expand in Oregon, creating 78 new jobs that pay over 180% of the average wage in the state, in addition to the other jobs totaling 135 jobs. So this is an extremely successful program. We are talking to two other companies that if one of them chooses to expand into Oregon, it'll deplete the remaining $2 million. So this is a program that will pay for itself in 2 years, and the state will start making money after that.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Just to add on to that, for the benefit of some of our new members, the concept is that there are forgivable loans associated with the amount of income tax that's created by new jobs by companies that are moving here or expanding. So we feel like it's been a good program, and it has a sunset on it. So this bill exists to extend that sunset. If we choose to move it, which we won't today, we go to Ways and Means to consider amongst the other priorities. So any questions for the director?
Thank you.
Got done very quickly. There isn't anyone else who has signed up for the bill. If there is anyone who would like to, please let us know now. I don't see any. So that's probably our quickest public hearing so far. So we'll close the public hearing. Jody, would you like to be heard?
Yes, 225.
Yes.
Sorry, I was having trouble getting it.
All those people behind you are waiting for another bill, so keep that in mind.
I know. They'll have to wait just a minute. Or maybe you should do me next.
You're the only person.
Okay. Thank you for waiting. For the record, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness of Oregon. And this program was started 2 years ago. Well, it actually was begun being used a year ago, and it was given an ample 10-year sunset at that time. And so it seems like we have had way too little time to know if this is an efficient and effective way to stimulate job growth. And so it doesn't seem prudent to be removing a sunset and having it just be a program that lasts forever, rather than waiting to have some analysis and some experience to go on. In the bill, the jobs must be traded sector, and they must average 150% of the state or county average wage, whichever is lesser. That means that in our high-income counties, we could actually be reducing the average earnings, because we would be blending with our low-income counties. It should be 150% of the county average wage, or the city average wage, not the state average wage. The benefit is forgivable loans to the employer equal to 2 years of personal income taxes of the employees. that would have been hired but for this benefit. That's a statement that they're required to sign, but of course, nobody hires someone unless they actually have work for them to do. And if they have work for them to do, a prudent employer would be hiring somebody, whether they're getting a benefit or not. Under Senate Bill, under that bill that was passed in 2011, Senate Bill 219, we got a program that started last January. It's too soon to be removing the sunset, so that would be our first suggestion. The second would be to require reports to this committee, the Ways and Means Committee, and the Revenue Committees periodically over the next 10 years so that everybody that's looking at all the different ways we provide benefits to businesses could see whether this was a good idea or not. And the third would be that we require the wages be 150% of county average. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for Jody? Representative Jody.
Is there anything that precludes the legislature if the sunset goes away from not funding them or giving them more restrictions down the road or whatever?
Well, it's money that goes... What happened last time around is we put $4 million, the Ways and Means earmarked $4 million of the Strategic Investment Fund.
Strategic
Reserve Fund to go to fund this. And I believe that's all been used up by two businesses.
Incorrect. Right? Just before you came in, we heard testimony that Oracle and Salesforce.com are the two that have been in that process, and there is some additional money, but that it may soon be depleted.
Okay. Hasn't been clear how much Oracle was getting in the press that I've seen. Yeah, I suppose so, but you would have to direct the governor not to spend the money that way.
Okay, but we have the power to go through and do that.
Ways and Means has the power to do that.
So yeah. 3 years down the road, if the promises aren't coming in, the legislature can still go through and either not fund
you'd
them
have
or
to
give them different directives.
Right.
Okay.
Right, you could.
Representative Cameron?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any counties that you know of that do not have an average wage that is at least equal to 150% of the state average wage? Or excuse me, are there any counties that have an average wage that is over 150,000 or 150% of the state average wage?
I understand the question.
It's about it varies from about $40,000 to $60,000, I think, but I'm just kind of remembering a chart. It's not very well fixed in my brain what the average wage is in some of the counties. I think that Washington County is in the low 60s, as I recall, and I really don't know what Josephine County is, for instance. But it seems to me it's in the 36 to 40 range, but I don't know.
Thank you.
But even still, if the idea is to be actually raising the... We've got this 10% hole that we're behind everybody else in what our per capita income is that people keep citing. This is supposed to be bringing high-wage traded sector jobs, and so it seems like they should be if that's the goal.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2225 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2267. Troy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2267 relating to film production provides that money is appropriated to Oregon Production Investment Fund for purposes of making reimbursements to local filmmakers may, if unexpected or unallocated at close of previous fiscal year, be used by Oregon Business Development Department for purpose of making reimbursements to filmmakers other than local filmmakers. Increases minimum amount of total actual Oregon expenses required for filmmaker other than local filmmaker to qualify for reimbursement. Increases credits for certified film production development contributions for fiscal year. Applies to fiscal years beginning on or after contributions for fiscal year. Takes effect on 91st day following adjournment. Sign and die.
Thank you, Troy. We have a number of people who have signed up here. We're going to start with Senator Johnson, Vince Porter, and Dr. Potowski, please. Vince, do you want to start us off, I'm guessing?
Go ahead.
Introduction?
No. Play through, Vince.
Only as a matter of introduction, and then we'll hear the good stories from Senator Johnson and Dr. Potowski.
Thank you. I plan to be as brief as possible. So, Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Vince Porter, and I'm the Executive Director of the Governor's Office of Film and Television. I know that there are many people here to testify, so as I said, I'll be very brief. Over the past year, thanks to the legislature's implementation of the Oregon Production Investment Fund, we've seen dramatic growth in Oregon's film and television industry. For some comparison, in 2008, the total amount of qualified Oregon expenses on projects accepted into the OPIF program was $48 million. In 2012, the OPIF projects exceeded $120 million in spending. For the last 2 years, this growth is in large part due to three television series being in production, along with five independent films and several animated projects. What's resulted is the employment of hundreds of Oregonians and engagement of over 1,000 local vendors throughout the state. We've also seen an improvement of local infrastructure for the industry and new opportunities arising for local small businesses. Now, this business is a word-of-mouth business, and thanks to our success, projects that have already been here in our state, the interest and the demand for more production in Oregon is at an all-time high. My office fields one to three inquiries about ready-to-go projects each month, all subject to available funds in OPIF. And just in the last month, we were contacted about two television pilots, one for NBC and another for CBS, that were ready to go for our state in March if we had sufficient OPIF funds, but were unable to make the deal work. Thanks to all this activity, I believe we have the opportunity to not only land more film and television production, but we're now positioned to be a player in the ever-changing digital media landscape. In the coming month, we'll announce a new effort with some high-profile partners in the tech and creative industries that will hopefully allow Oregon to further capitalize on the results of the Oregon Production Investment Fund. And for additional reference, I've submitted some documentation on the bill, a brief synopsis of the recent economic study that Dr. Potowski will speak about, a detailed breakdown of how the Oregon Production Investment Fund works, and also a map showing how we rank with 40 other states in the country that offer similar film incentives. I'm happy to answer any other questions. Otherwise, I'll defer the rest of the time to everyone else.
Thank you very much. Please stick around. I imagine we will have questions. Senator Johnson.
Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Betsy Johnson, and I am proud to introduce myself as the Senator from Halloween Town, Ring 2, From Oregon with Love, Dune, Goonies, Kindergarten Cop, Date with an Angel, Benji the Hunted, Short Circuit, Grimm, Free Willy, and that perennial favorite, Rockaday Richie and the Queen of the Hop. I appear today to encourage you and by extension the entire legislature to do whatever we can to encourage film, video, and television production in Oregon. In my old life, our helicopters flew on many of the movies that I have just named. I was one of the lead pilots in the seminal series From Oregon with Love that helped cement the enduring relationships between Japan and Oregon. And I flew one of the three Benjis on Benji the Hunted. I can attest that 25 years after Goonies was filmed in Astoria, cash registers still ring like church bells whenever there's a Goonies gathering or anniversary. On the 25th anniversary, every hotel room was sold out in the region. I ended up sleeping on the mayor's couch the night of the big gala. Restaurants were packed. Visitors came from multiple countries. The economic impact was breathtaking. Filming in Oregon draws on our indigenous strengths. Hauntingly beautiful scenery on both sides of the Cascades, a skilled workforce across the trades, agencies and municipalities eager to be nimble during the permitting process, a robust hospitality industry, a rich talent pool, including internationally recognized artists, including one of my constituents, Gus Van Zandt, and one of our colleagues, former Representative David Edwards, just releasing his full-length movie into the international marketplace. This is a clean industry. It's a natural fit for Oregon. It's a smart investment, and I hope you will look favorably on House Bill 2267. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. And if you need to leave, please do so freely.
Thank you.
Dr. Potowski.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, co-chairs, members of the Transportation and Economic Development Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Potowski. I am director of the my own research center. What? I don't know the name.
it's one letter away from NERD. That's what you told us last time.
Yes. Northwest Economic Research Center.
There you go. And
with me today, behind me, is who will join us here, is Jeff Renfro, a senior economist with NERC at Portland State University. So I'm going. We were going to give you sort of a high level of the study that we did for the Office of Film and TV. We were commissioned by the Governor's Office and the Portland Development Commission to look at what is the economic impact from the film and television industry, and also what are the impacts of the production incentive programs that Oregon and Portland Metropolitan Area has instituted. So we used a number of data sources in terms of looking at this. You have two graphs on your sheet, one showing the overall Oregon film and video production, and is the top line, with the television broadcasting the bottom line, and then breaking out just the Portland metro area is the bottom graph. Now, one of the things I want to notice about these graphs is that if we think about the business cycle, the Oregon industry definitely experienced a loss of jobs. But compared to the recession of the early 2000s, the impact on our most recent recession was less severe and recovery was faster. It's difficult to attribute this to incentives, but the film and television industry definitely fared better than the economy as a whole in Oregon, and in particular in the Portland metro area. Oh, I can advance this for you. My apologies. And you can see that bottom graph there, especially in the film and video for the Portland metro area. Really, right after we got into 2008, we had quite a large drop in employment throughout the state, and even the Portland metro area. But here you can see, you can hardly see it, but there's a little slight dip for the Portland employment in the film and video industry, but then continued to grow. Overall, you're looking at close to about a 26% growth rate, growth from 2007 through 2011, which not very many industries were able to even come close to what that growth was. Now, down below here, we use a package that's called IMPLAN. IMPLAN is a way of trying to look at what are the direct impacts that occur to a particular industry, and also what are all the related industries that help support that industry do work. And then, so the direct impacts, as we say here, these are the ones that are direct spending by, let's say, a firm outside, out-of-state production company comes into town, like Grimm, and what are they dollar-for-dollar spending, and what are they hiring? Now, that company, that production, needs a lot of support. And so there are a lot of supporting industries, being lighting crews, staging crews, so on. And these are the indirect impacts that affect the supply chain for the industry. And then all these people do get paid, and they spend money in the community. And that's what the induced impacts are related to. So the chart down below here shows overall what we found for Oregon. And let me tell you, what we did too here is that we're specifically looking at the film and video production industry. So we look at film and video production. We look at television broadcasting. But not included in this is, like, for example, radio is not included in this. In the film and TV production area, sound recording is not included. So we really tried to narrow the scope of the definition of what we were looking at. Now, what we found is, as I said, television broadcasting subsector in the industry tends to be much more diversified throughout the state relative to the video production and film production, which is more concentrated in the Portland metro area. And our definition was Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties. As it says here, Portland metro was home to 82% of the out-of-state production jobs, 67% of the total industry jobs. The growth of this industry also has other positive effects. It provides jobs for those that are college educated for the film and video industry. It also provides jobs for a class of people that we're concerned about. We're, of course, concerned about all classes of people, but the creative class. And it does, as Senator Johnson mentioned, does raise the profile nationally of Oregon and also the Portland metro area. Now, while this industry, as we've seen in the graphs, tend to be healthy and we're growing, we also want to look to see to what extent the tax incentives helped this type of growth. Now, we assume that this is all related to the out-of-state production aspects. And so when we look at the tax incentives and the impacts they had on jobs and output and income levels and also tax revenues, we concentrate on that out-of-state production firms. So what we found is that the total of the incentive programs in 2011 was about $11.8 million. This is, we're looking at a calendar year, so it bridges two fiscal years, so you get a little bit more than what the cap was for the incentive program, so it's up to 11.8. And we found that the incentive programs generated 43% of foregone revenue allocated to the program. So it did not fully fund the program. It returned about 43%. This is not out of line with other states that we've looked at, especially like Florida. And Florida is a relatively lower business tax burden state, and we believe that Oregon fits into that category. Now, keep that in mind. When we're saying this, you also want to keep in mind what this industry does. And it really does help. And the out-of-state productions come here when you have a highly skilled workforce that knows how to work in this industry. We were told basically by some of the production people that they think they are saving somewhere between $50,000 to $60,000 on a day if they have a well-qualified workforce rather than one that's not. So that's very important here. And so this sort of public infrastructure, private infrastructure, call it, that there are sound stages, you have crews that are experienced, skilled labor force, these also help defer the costs of out-of-state production function, out-of-state production facilities coming into the state. So definitely a skilled, experienced workforce is necessary to attract work coming in. And we believe that these incentives help build up this private infrastructure. And once this private infrastructure does rise up, that allows for more productions to come in. And with that, we can take some questions.
Very good. Other questions for Dr. Petoskey? I'll ask one, which just was prompted by your last point about the savings that are available as a result of skilled workforce. What, if anything, have you seen in other states or in your research that gives us any clue as to whether that benefit continues if the incentive disappears? In other words, are these productions going to stick if we choose not to continue the incentive?
Mr. Chair, in interviewing some of the producers for these programs, the indication is that one of the reasons they would come here rather than to a state that may have had incentives but doesn't have the qualified workforce is that cost savings. For the firms that are located here that helps supply these services for these out-of-state film productions, they need year-round work. It seems that if the incentives go away, some of the businesses would go away, these firms in Oregon would also have probably less employment, and they'd be searching for work outside of the state rather than inside.
Thank you. Representative Doherty, then Representative Lightman.
With the film and television industry that we have here in Oregon, how much of kind of what I refer to as domino effect with jobs, you have a film company come in and they have to hire trucks and vans and caterers and buy food and stay in restaurants. Is all of that, and they're staying in hotels and all that kind of thing, is all of that factored into the benefit of having the tax credit? and the credits that we have,
Mr.
the
Chair,
incentives.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Daugherty. Yes. All that aspect of supply chain. And what you want to think about it, too, and this goes back to Representative Reed's comments. If you don't have the trucking here, if you don't have the soundstage stuff, you don't have lighting crews, they have to bring that in from outside. And that becomes very expensive. And so it's a real advantage to have these year-round, you know, experienced companies here. And you're absolutely right. I mean, in our analysis includes that. We had from Vince Porter's office, you know, down to the stage manager bought a sandwich at the store,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so that expenditure is included in the analysis.
Okay.
Chair Reed, may I make one comment? When you asked about the left behind, I mean, actually, there are a few people here that will be testifying later. One thing that we're seeing is that the projects that are bringing the higher level shows like Grimm and Leverage are actually driving additional business to local firms because they have suddenly provided a level of expertise to show off internationally. And I think you'll find some interesting stories later where not only are you getting projects directly related to the incentives, but those projects are leading to additional income for local businesses and some really great stories that you'll hear later.
That's great. Thank you. Representative Lively.
Well, I have a question, and probably goes to just my lack of fully understanding this program, but you made a comment, the employment returns for the program are strong, but the tax revenue raised through increased activity did not fully fund the program. I'm not sure exactly what that's saying.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lively, in our way of structuring the study, and we concentrated on the out-of-state production firms. These tend to be larger outfits, larger impacts that occur. So the job impact tend to be a little larger than, say, we've seen some other studies. At the same time, the incentives that are given, and we're relatively lower, what I would call effective business tax rate, the revenues are not as strong as some of the other studies. And, you know, and no sales tax, which is an advantage of one of the reasons they're coming here. But in terms of revenue, mm-hmm. the expenditure, we don't get that part.
Okay. That helps. Thanks.
Very good. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is an old question for Vince, but it's this. I notice it shows up on one of the pages here where it says there are other positive effects, and the last one listed is raising the profile of Oregon and Portland nationally. And the question was, how do you measure that value? And we had this discussion. I think this must be the fourth time I've asked the question, and I'm not sure how to measure it. And I noticed that, Tom, you didn't measure it either, but maybe you can give us a guess.
Chair Reed, I'll try and tackle Vice Chair Benz. You know, I think it's clearly the toughest one to measure. I mean, Senator Johnson's comments earlier about tourism impact directly affected is one area, and we don't have the data to be able to measure like how many people are traveling in for Goonies. I can tell you like Goonies is a great example. We have a blog post on our blog about that 25th anniversary that happened 2 years ago, and we still every month like 25 people from around the world just read about the Goonies and on our blog, and it's interesting just to track how that continues to stay because of that project. You know, what's the value of having a show like Grimm or Portlandia on every single night or every single week or 22 nights a week? I think there is absolutely value there with just the profile of Portland. I'm not sure everyone's comfortable with the image that Portlandia portrays, but I can tell you, you know, on the web now, Travel Portland is advertising on the web videos that they're promoting, and clearly they see the value of advertising and promotion for that show.
Follow up, please.
Thank you. So is this why we don't see Sponsored by Oregon at the end of the credits? Is this, I mean, where is the notoriety opportunity if you don't want to be burdened by the aspects of Portlandia people may not like? How do we make sure we're getting appropriate value for the investment when it comes to the public publicity elements of these things?
Vice Chair Vince. We do have in our provision on when contractually they're allowed to give us a credit, and that is the case on feature films. On television, the credits go by so fast that we don't enforce that credit. I mean, we could certainly revisit it. I think in the case of Portlandia, the notoriety speaks for itself, but in the case of Grimm or others, although we certainly are seeing more and more interest on that show as well in terms of just overall notoriety. Is that what your...
No, follow up. You're right. Well, my question really is, are we maximizing the opportunity for promoting Oregon when we utilize this tax credit? And maybe you could explain to us what you do require of those folks that use it so we can enjoy the positives that these activities generate.
Right.
And whether that's in the credits or whether that's something else they have to do, put a big something on the side of their truck that says part paid for by Oregon or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's my question.
Thank you. Okay. Chair Benz, what we focus on as opposed to having a specific do this is just relationship building. I mean, in the case with NBC and Comcast, we continue to develop relationships. We have a phone call scheduled for next week where we're going to be talking to them how we can expand our presence with them digitally on the website with Oregon and specifically Oregon companies and how we can help them have a greater presence on the web. But as far as anything specific that is required, we haven't, other than a credit, we have not had anything additional.
Thank you.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. When I traveled to Eugene's sister city in Japan, Kakagawa, many years ago, the show I Love Oregon was playing on television. And there were so many people that I ended up meeting in Japan, not only in the sister city, but as I traveled around, who were becoming familiar with Oregon. And it was, at that time, I gather travel was a little bit easier and the exchange rate was different. But there were a number of people who wanted to come to Oregon instead of some other state because they had heard about Oregon. So I know that these things work, and Eugene being home to Animal House, I know that I've gotten teased about that, but some people have actually asked me, how do I get to it? Where do I see it? So I know that they were in Eugene at least for a day or so, wanting to know where Animal House is. I wonder, has there ever been any particular marketing suggested for Travel Oregon, as we know advertisements or even sometimes whole sections are placed in magazines and journals? Anything, we know there are things around visit wine country or visit the coast or come here for skiing or, you know, bicycling. Has there been anything targeted as come visit as something related to film and video industry?
Chair Reed, Representative Nathanson, the one thing I do know is I was sent Travel Oregon's advertising portfolio about when they are advertising, and they actually are advertising nationally and regionally on the broadcast of Grimm as one example where they're capitalizing. They want their message out in between the commercial breaks on that show. So, I mean, it's more of a question for where they see their value and how it matches with their overall strategy. And we talk frequently about how we can capitalize it, and when, you know, we have the right projects, we'll keep moving on that.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.
One other comment, and this is more of a comment. When you're talking about Oregon, is that I saw on a national television show, one of the producers of Grimm, before they started, said that they actually wanted it set someplace else, fictionally. It was going to be in Boston or something like that, but they fell in love with Portland. And that's when they decided that they were going to use the Portland Police Bureau, and so in the Portland police cars, and so at least they saw that kind of thing. It was that comment, and they also fell in love with Oregon because apparently it's supposed to be taking place in the Black Forest, and they found out that they didn't have to put moss on the trees. because the moss was already there. So I'm not quite sure that's the kind of notoriety we want, but it was on a variety show that is quite watched quite by quite a few people. And there was the producer of the show happened to be Sean Hayes, was just touting and Oregon.
You.
So that was just a little bit, but that and the moss on our trees.
Thank you, Representative Doherty. We have a whole bunch of other people here to testify, and we appreciate you kicking us off. Representative Bailey, thanks for your patience. If you'd like to come on up. We also have Doug Cooley and David Echepar. Thank you for your patience. Please.
Thank you. Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jules Bailey. I have the honor of representing House District 42. It's my pleasure to be here today in support of OPIF, as we've come to call it. As some of you may remember, and certainly Chair Reed and Vice Chair Benz from being on the committee last time around, in the last session, we had an expiration of the Film and Video Incentive Program and went through a fairly difficult decision-making process around a number of different expiring tax incentive programs to decide which ones to continue, how much to continue them by. And this was one of those that made the cut because the evidence was there that this was returning a value to Oregonians and that it was structured in a way that was responsible and where we could count on the investment that was coming in to the state. Literally, we could count the receipts because that's how the program is structured. And so I want to just reinforce a story about this incentive program that I think is illustrative of the overall program. I had an opportunity to visit the set of Grimm at one point, and while the action on the set was interesting, what was more interesting to me was the opportunity to be able to go and visit one of the trucks that was parked outside. And I went into that truck and met two constituents who are local guys, obviously live in my district, and are grips for the production and had been hired by the crew that came in to provide a lot of the work for the cameras as they're filming. And what they told me when I talked to them was that before Grimm came to town, they had been working on a number of other productions, on commercials, on shoots, but they hadn't had the certainty to be able to go out and make the investment to buy their own truck. And because of the work that Grimm had brought in for them, and because they were able to count on it through this production incentive credit or fund, they had been able to make that investment, to take the leap, to buy the truck, to get the long-term capital infrastructure there that was going to allow them to more cost-effectively market their services to the next show that came in. And that's the kind of stickiness that I think that this program has. It's the kind of story that I think we want to encourage, that it's not just about giving an incentive to the shows that are coming in and filming. It's about giving the certainty in the marketplace to our local producers and our local folks that are working on everything from films that are coming in from other places or shows that are coming in from other places to locally produced films and movies, to be able to have that local capacity to provide the best, most talented services that this state can provide. So I'm in full support of OPIF. I'm happy to be in front of you today and happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you, Representative. In respecting Representative Bailey's time, let's ask if there are any questions for him. And if not, we can bid you farewell. Thanks for your testimony.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Cooley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Cooley. I represent Comcast, NBC Universal, who films Grimm in Portland and around various parts of the state. And just here to express my support, perhaps see if you have any questions for the program. We have just a little bit of background, and I'll be brief. On a given day, approximately 300 employees on average. Employed directly, I think we're, at last glance, maybe 94% Oregonians, and spend about a little over $2 million every episode, every 8 days in the community and making those television programs. As Vince mentioned earlier, NBC was one of those companies that had other projects that they would like to bring to Portland. I think the pilot was Bloodlines, and it ended up somewhere else based on limitations of a budget and some other things, of course, as well. But there, I think, it's obvious from Vince and some of the other data that there are projects that could be done that are getting turned away. So demand is high, and it's good for the state to have that demand for these kind of jobs. So with that, I would simply let you know that I support the bill in front of you and see if you have any questions.
Thank you very much. Let's hear from you first. And I don't want to mispronounce your name again, but if you'd like to introduce yourself as you start, we appreciate it.
My name is David Edgepair, and I work with Dennis's 70s Landscaping and Garden Centers, and we're a family-owned business. I've been managing the Powell store for 22 years, and it's a family-owned business. We have four retail nurseries, landscape, and the industry has been, you know, really good to us because we do plant rentals, and when you have plant rentals, the nice thing about it is that we rent them plants, and then we get the plants back. So we'll rent them at 50% of the cost, and so, you know, the first time we rent them, we've got our cost on the plant back. And we'll rent the same plant sometimes two and three times because the industry doesn't want to maintain plants. They've got their job to do. And we've done a lot of infomercials, Sony commercials, Toyota commercials. We've worked on Leverage and Grimm, and more recently, as some of the bigger productions have come to town, it's been really good for us because they come in and they'll spend $1,000, $2,000, $2,500 in one day. It may not be a lot of money for a lot of places, but for a small nursery, that's a lot of money. I look back last year in January and wonder why January wasn't as good this year, and I found a $1,000 day that Grimm had spent just in one day. I was looking back, and they started a little later this year. And so those kind of numbers for us, you know, really help us. It allows us to have more employees year-round. We're open year-round, but we're very, very seasonal. And in the spring, we make most of our money in the spring, a little bit at Christmas. But being open year-round, there's very, very slow times. And the industry shoots commercials and films all year long. So that helps us, you know, during those slow times. And when we're purchasing the plants, we're purchasing plants from local people. So when we're getting local plants, they're making money. They've got their staff. Our staff makes money. The company makes money. We're spending the money over and over in town as you know, one person makes a dollar, then the next person spends it. You know, it goes around and around. The other thing I've noticed is I'll get customers that will come in and say, oh, I've worked on Grimm or I've worked on Leverage. They're renting props. They're renting properties. And so they're coming and spending money at 70s. So we get some of the money that's spent, you know, at other places too. So, you know, all in all, it's a good industry for us. Little things like I'm a Royal Rosarian, and you know, they helped us with the auction. Grimm put in something for the auction, a signed poster that we were able to auction off, and so it makes them part of the community. Also, they're not just here and gone. And my experience with the industry has been really, really good. The people I deal with have been good people, and because of that, we'll get a call from LA. Someone wants to be in town just for a week. They want to do a quick shoot or something. We've got the plants. They know who to call, and it's you know, it's extra money for us that we weren't counting on, that we hadn't, you know, budgeted. It's just extra money. So that's always good to have more money. And with that, I'll conclude. Answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for this panel? Representative Benz.
Thank you. So does Comcast have a template that you can share with Vince that shows exactly what you look for when you're selecting a location so he can adjust those things that aren't tax credit driven? Or maybe you can share with us what it is that we should be doing here in Oregon that doesn't require money to make us more attractive.
Mr. Chair and Representative Benz, I don't have a set template because I guess each project is a little different depending on the nature of this, you know, the story and that kind of thing. But there are a few criteria that obviously anybody looks at, and I think an incentive program and a skilled workforce are probably on the top of the list, and it depends on the project and that. But those are definitely criteria that I've heard producers and that I've heard NBC talk about when they look at other projects. Are those two things? And if you don't have those, it's very tough to make the list at all. So,
and the skilled workforce, how are we doing there,
Mr. Chair and Representative? Better. It's with productions like Grimm and Leverage and some of the other animation and special effects that are in Portland and do some of those things for us, it's a growing workforce. So that's actually an advantage to keeping these jobs and keeping this program going, is that you are developing a workforce for the next one and the next one. And these individuals have an opportunity to hone their skills, develop their resume, and be better prepared for a following film or television crew that may come, or a production that may come next year or the year after. So,
final question. Where are we on the list of states?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't have an exact, again, a list, but I know that Oregon's, so I'll give you some anecdotal feel as best I can. NBC recognizes that Oregon's film production, and, you know, the incentive as it exists now at $6 million is not the largest. It's probably towards the smaller end of the group. But it is steady, and it is here. And I think that gives them the predictability that they'd like. Moving from $6 million to $12 million, as proposed in the bill, is not as dramatic of a step as you might think relative to the other programs, you know, in Canada, in Louisiana, and places like that, that essentially have almost unlimited, you know, dramatically, New York, some of those incentive programs that are massive. But it is a measured step that I think is positive and gives Oregon a chance to expand and show a sign of growth and bring that workforce development with it, so that it's not a hot, cold type of cycle, but a steady indicator of steady growth. And that kind of predictability and that steady growth is the kind of stuff that NBC looks for.
You said that last time.
That's right.
Go ahead. So you said that these other states are utilizing the opportunity in ways that makes the credit apparently more attractive to them. That is, the expenditure that's not reimbursed through it recovered with taxes. So is there some advice you'd give us on what it is that they're doing in New York that makes them happier to spend that delta that's not recovered in the form of taxes? Is it promotion of New York, or is it attracting more tourists to New York? Is it, what is it that makes them want to spend that much money on their state and us not? They're apparently not they're not getting it back, I'm guessing, any better than we are.
That's Mr. Chair and Representative Bentz. There is a different climate, I think, part of it political, in the different states about the type of jobs and the type of industry they want to bring in. So I can't answer that question. I can't put words in the other states' minds. But I think if I were to offer some minor insight, I think there's the possibility that certain states, or perhaps certain programs or certain legislatures, if you will, have more of a, you know, brick-and-mortar approach to job creation. Some have more of a creativity. Some are going for more green opportunities. It's a variety of desires that I think at a given legislature they may have a different mindset. So you're right, each state, it does turn into a bit of an arms race. You know, you want to be competitive with the other states. But by the same token, we've seen some of those states that have gone sort of hot and cold, flavor of the month. It seemed so exciting, but it wasn't really part of their goal. And so they tried it, and maybe it didn't work out with the economy, or it didn't make the priority list. Oregon keeping it on the list and keeping it steady in growth sends that message of predictability and commitment, I think, to this type of industry, these type of jobs, the green, the creative, and the technology side of it. I think it sends a message about what this body wants. It's hard for me to put words in the other legislator's mouth, but I think that's the general tone.
Yeah, that's an excellent answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have to keep it moving, unfortunately. We have a lot of folks yet to testify. Andy Mingo, Jose Bejar, Scotty Isseri. Gentlemen, we have a relatively full agenda, so to the extent you can keep your comments brief and not repeat things that have already been said, except to the extent say I agree, that would be great.
Chairman Reed, members of the committee, my name is Andy Mingo. I'm the program director for the digital media program at Clackamas Community College. So in order for us, I mean, we fully support OPIF. And in order for us to explain that to you, we got to give you a little bit of an idea about what we do at Clackamas. Basically, we supply or offer an Associate's of Applied Science degree in digital media. We offer classes in video production, film studies, computer animation, audio engineering. And since 2008, we've seen a tripling of our class enrollment. We've gone from 97 students to 300 students a year. And one of our big things that we do at Clackamas for our program is that we offer an internship opportunities through our cooperative work experience program at the college, meaning we offer college credit for interns to work on productions. And for the past 4 years, we've had a number of internships landed with companies such as Funnelbox, Univision, Nike, Portland Trailblazers, MTV, Leverage, Episode 303, film productions such as Management, Touching Comedy, which was an OPIF recipient that starred Jennifer Aniston. We also supply media interns for basically government offices such as the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. And also, we've just landed a internship with the Business of Economic Development with Clackamas County. This office in particular has really done wonders for us specifically. Our intern's going to be helping set up a film location database for potential production companies to be coming in. They're also going to be setting up a one-stop film permitting system in Clackamas County. And they're also conducting conversations for supplying broadband for post-production facilities in Clackamas County. I mention this because Catherine Comer from the Clackamas County Business and Economic Development Office also helps facilitate our endeavors with that of the industry. And in fact, just recently, she helped us place or begin talks with placing three interns with Electric Entertainment's new pilot starring Gina Davis. So, I mean, these are the things that we're seeing from the college and from education in the state of Oregon. Digital media and film production really represents a new wave for us, in particular for job training. What we're seeing is that a lot of so for job retraining is one of our central goals at Clackamas Community College. Our educational opportunities for students to hone their media production skills to the point that they become viable hires is actually very important for us. And so just to cut it short, really the expansion of the industry will offer jobs for our students, will offer educational opportunities for our students as well. And so the digital media program at Clackamas Community College fully supports OPIF.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Mr. Bihar, we have your written testimony, so if you could just summarize that.
Absolutely.
We appreciate it. We will read it.
Absolutely. Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today in favor of OPIF. I just wanted to take the opportunity
and
to
share. And I'm sorry to interrupt again. I have to ask you to identify yourself for the record.
My name is Jose Bihar.
Thank you.
The head of business development for Electric Entertainment and co-producer of Leverage. I would like to share some of the successes that we had with this program here in Oregon, my home state. I myself started as a production assistant, and now I'm a senior executive for Dean Devlin's company. And we continue to focus our efforts on expanding Oregon's economy and providing jobs for Oregonians like myself. When Dean Devlin first brought Leverage to Oregon, the infrastructure wasn't that mature to be able to support our production. Since then, 64 episodes later, $100 million spent, and a couple thousand of jobs provided to Oregonians, we are seeing the effects of this program where we have shows like Grimm, our colleagues at Grimm, Portlandia. We have some of the other projects that are being produced by local filmmakers. I would like to note that our industry is at its core a manufacturing industry. We produce, we package, and we export these products worldwide. Leverage alone is in over 60 countries. And earlier, Vice Chair Representative Benz, you were asking about what kind of what benefit does Oregon get from this exposure? Well, I remember the conversations with when Grimm was still trying to decide where they were going to take their show, and our line producer spoke to their showrunner and pitched the idea of coming to Oregon because of all the benefits. Outside of the incentive, it's a two-hour flight from Los Angeles, so we can be going back and forth, send our drives for post-production within a day. The no sales tax and the incredible crew member base that we have in the state. Our commitment to Oregon remains strong. Dean Devlin's commitment to Oregon remains strong. And while Leverage has was not renewed for a sixth season, we are now going to bring a pilot for TNT. We're going to be shooting it here in Oregon. It's going to be starring Gina Davis. And we have another feature film that we are bringing to Oregon as well. Now, unfortunately, the realities of those limitations of the fund forced us to make the very difficult decision, financial decision, to move one of our biggest productions this year to Louisiana. But like my colleague, Mr. Cooley, indicated, we have come long ways from where we were, and this is a great step in the right direction. And we remain committed. We will bring jobs to Oregon. We want to continue our pipeline. And we want to partner with you to make sure that we contribute to Oregon's economy.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We appreciate your testimony. Mr. Osseri.
I didn't bring enough change for the meter, so I'll be quick. Chair Reid, members of the committee, my name is Scotty Osseri. I'm the founder of a company called Funda. We make games that are fun to play and shows that are fun to watch. I'm an Oregon native. I graduated from Ontario High School and from Salem, Oregon, Willamette University. So it's their fault. our first show that we created is called The Digits, and we mix online videos and mobile apps that teaches kids a math curriculum. In the 21st century, the difference between a technology company and a media company gets smaller every day. The way we tell stories changes. When was the last time you saw a commercial that you couldn't fast forward through or click to close? We can view our stories on the big screen or in the palm of your hand. We can see them in real time with a virtual audience of our friends, or we can take control of that story and change the outcome. So my company crosses these borders of media. We're a technology company and a film studio. We make linear narratives that the audience controls. We build old school puppets, and then we film and distribute them with cutting edge technology. And we make awesome technology. And we use it to teach kids to love math. We're greatly honored to be accepted into the Oregon Production Incentive Fund. When we launched our first show last year, last quarter actually, about 4 months ago, and we now have thousands of users, and we've signed partnership deals with PBS, We Are Teachers, Skype and YouTube, and we've received great press from national publications such as GigaOM, Wired, and Red Tricycle. We were invited to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas for the nomination for Best Educational Series, and it was a fantastic honor to be nominated and to represent Oregon and Oregon-produced projects among web creators from all over the world. And that's what you say when you don't win. It was fine. One of our actors won $75 on the Wheel of Fortune. It wasn't a total loss. We're a young company. We're about 3 months out, but we've had some enormous successes, and we couldn't have done it without the Production Incentive Fund. As best we can tell, we're one of the first new media productions to be accepted into a incentive program like this, and I believe it shows Oregon film and the state's commitment to next generation storytelling and technology. The voice of support from the OPIF is putting us on track to grow into a multi-million dollar business. We're building a long-lasting company that can provide quality full-time jobs for Oregonians, and all the while doing something awesome that makes kids smarter. Last year we employed 30 Oregonians, used mostly Oregon vendors for our sets, our curriculum, our costumes, our PR and marketing, and our post-production. And our partnership with Skype is letting us do a lot of educational outreach with our content. And our first is going to be my alma mater, Alameda Elementary, sometime in April. We've secured additional investment from San Francisco, and tomorrow I'm going down to Medford to meet with additional investors and technology folks down there, some of the developers in that community. So we're only looking to grow from there. The state's commitment to next-generation media and storytelling through the OPIF can place it at the forefront of new business models and new revenues. And this is a perfect time to nurture these independent companies and turn Oregon into a hub for this type of creative development. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the story. Other questions? Representative McEwen.
Real quickly, could you quantify for us what tipped the decision to Louisiana?
The limited funds in OPEF, because we are talking about a project that's over $100 million. And however, we worked very, very hard to be able to bring the smaller projects here because we fell in love with Oregon. I mean, I'm an Oregonian, but Dean Devlin has fallen in love with Oregon and all the other benefits that we've discussed as well.
Thank you. And just before, how do you spell FUNDA?
FUNDA.
Thank you.
We also have a website, watchthedigits.com.
Second, I can't find it.
Yeah. I have a sticker if you'd like.
I was about to ask. I think all of the committee and probably the rest of the legislature will be following your progress. We want you to come back and give us an update later on.
I'd love to. Can I bring the robot and the alien?
That's right. Representative Benz.
Well, I just wanted to welcome Scotty here and tell him that his father's been checking with me constantly just to report back on how he did. And so no pressure on you.
What are you going to say?
How'd I do?
I haven't decided yet. No, you did great. Thank you.
It's nice to have a Bearcat before us as well. We appreciate it. Thank you very much. Next up, Gretchen Miller, Rob S-H-O, and I can't tell if the last letter is an N or a W. But Shaw. Okay. Thank you. And Nathaniel
Good
Applefield.
Luck.
It was close. I had said I'd just say the letter rather than guess. Miller, you want to get it started?
Sure. Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Gretchen Miller, and I'm a partner at Hive Effects. We specialize in visual effects and animation. Our story is simple. We started roughly 5 years ago and have managed to get by with an average of 10 to 15 employees with mostly local projects. When Grimm came along, it changed everything. It took us from a regional company to a company that can attract national work. Because of Grimm, we were able to hire an additional 15 employees while spending roughly $50,000 in computers and software. Our labor costs for 2012 exceeded $1.2 million, and our gross revenue has doubled from 2010. Because of Grimm, we have a reel that can be used to sell our services to companies around the world. An example of such is a project that came to us from Russia. They saw our work on Grimm and contacted us to supervise the visual effects for a film involving creatures that morph. Although the movie was shot in Oklahoma, they are choosing to come to us for the visual effects because of our work on Grimm. Furthermore, I would like to mention the local talent that we've been able to train. Many of our new hires have come from the Art Institute, some of which were quite green, but showed a lot of raw talent and an incredible will to learn. I'm very proud of our crew and of the skills that they have acquired because of the opportunities Grimm has provided. Because of these skill sets, our employees will be able to remain competitive in a very challenging field. My hope is that because of the film incentives and the work that we've done for Grimm, is that films will start to take their visual effects here as well. Please help us make that happen. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Shaw, I can hardly see you back there, but I'm not sure Representative Benz appreciates being caricatured like this. But
Mr. Chair,
Representative Cameron,
are we going to toll those?
We might.
Ms. Shaw. There to distract you from how nervous and sweaty I am.
Oh, no, you're fine.
Hello, my name is Rob Shaw. I have been a director at Bent Image Labs since 2005. Bent Image Labs is an animation production studio in Southeast Portland. The studio began in 2002 and has produced hundreds of projects in its over 10 years. The company currently employs somewhere between 100 to 120 artists and production staff. Bent can expand up to 160-plus people on special projects. As a director at Bent, I've had the opportunity to direct numerous projects, including multiple commercials, music videos, and short films all over the world. The great part about my job is I get to do something that I love and be part of entertainment that is seen by audiences that span the planet. Since we work on a global scale, Bent is best leveraged by content that is seen on a national or international stage. The wonderful part about having Oregon's Production Investment Fund is its ability to attract projects that are seen on this scale. Shows like Grimm and Portlandia that air internationally give us the opportunity to showcase our work to a much larger audience. This allows us to build credibility on a global scale and affiliate our brand with projects that raise our profile in a very competitive and critical industry. Since directing the stop-motion rat segment for Portlandia, I've had several clients tell me specifically that they love the Portlandia rats. Our contacts through Portlandia have also led us to work on other shows, such as directing the animated portion on a segment called Demo Monster of Kroll Show, a Comedy Central show. Subsequently, our visual effects works on NBC's Grimm has also helped us to garner interest from other parties looking for help on visual effects heavy projects. Projects like Grimm and Portlandia give us notoriety and allow Bent to compete on higher levels within the industry. By continuing to attract these projects through OPIF, Bent will be able to compete with industry heavy cities like Los Angeles, New York, or Vancouver, BC. It helps to build our production pipeline, create jobs, and position Bent as a great contender in a global marketplace. Passing House Bill 2267 will not only help us keep our infrastructure strong, but by adding additional funds, we will attract even more production to the area, which could potentially provide more opportunities for our industry's growth. I hope you will continue to support Oregon Production Investment Fund and companies like Bent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw. Mr. Applefield.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Nathaniel Applefield. I serve as executive director for the Portland Local of Screen Actors Guild and the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, representing over 900 of the state's performers, broadcasters, and recording artists. I'm also a board member at large at the Oregon Media Production Association, working to promote and represent the entire media production industry in Oregon. As many of you know, the Oregon Production Investment Fund has been hugely successful. With just $6 million a year, last year alone, we brought in almost $130 million in out-of-state dollars for media production. There are over 40 states in the union with a program like ours, and we rank in the bottom third as far as what we are offering in a rebate or a reimbursement fund. Having said that, we are absolutely winning the competition against other states with a modest fund, and what we need to be doing is looking for ways to expand the amount of work that we can bring in under the same exact terms that we've been using now for several years. The demand to come and shoot in Oregon is at an all-time high, while we are being essentially bottlenecked by a lack of supply. So last year was fantastic, and while we brought in nearly $130 million of production, what we lost once our fund had run dry was that much and probably much, much more. So we're building right now a fantastic reputation amongst the national media production industry for being a place that you can go and get any project you want to get done in Oregon. We have the cast, we have the crew, we have the support services necessary to get a film done, a television show, a video game, you name it. We can do it here in Oregon, and people want to come here so badly that we will win against other states that are offering less. What we need is a more robust fund so that we can keep this growth going. And so I'm asking for your support for House Bill 2267, which is exactly what Oregon needs to keep growth in this industry. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We used to think about this as being film and video, but now we understand that it's film, video, and other sorts of things, other sorts of media, including games, for example. If we had only the amount of money that we've been investing in the past, how does that impact the part of the industry that we've been traditionally supporting and encouraging, film and video? How is that impacted if we expand the uses to cover other things? In other words, the purpose is broadened, but what if the amount of money was not broadened? What happens then?
I'm going to step in, and unless you guys want to say something about that, and suggest that that is an excellent question that we might take up with Vince from the governor's office, who might be in a little bit better position to speak about the various channels. And in fact, it's a good preview of a conversation I expect we'll have when the Oregon Innovation Plan, the Oregon Innovation Council, is before us, as the Oregon Storyboard really is at the center of that collision between digital worlds. So if you're okay with that, maybe we can follow up with Vince.
Chair Reed, I would love to address this.
Sure,
as well.
Sure, go ahead.
The Oregon Media Production Association is supporting an amendment to this bill that would allow for a slight expansion. We are seeing firms like Hive and Bent and video game firms around the state who are now growing and growing more as a secondary result from OPIF. What we would like to see as a trial run, if HB 2267 passes and expands from $6 to $12 million a year, is we use the IOPIF 5% reserve that is to be used for indigenous-only productions. We would love to see that expanded to include the scope of work that would be video game production and post-production, so that we can help keep growing our indigenous industry here by expanding it to those kinds of work.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Representative Cameron? Don't ask about tolling.
Thank you.
Huh? No tolling on the...
No. I was just going to... Mr. Shaw, thank you for bringing those. And I just watched one of your videos online. I think
that's why you were paying attention.
But I didn't turn the sound up. I was watching and paying attention. But I think I want to. This is serious. I want to encourage you to bring those types of things to show to the committee, because it entertains us a whole lot more and gets us a lot more excited too.
Good.
To see what some of the real things that are happening in front of the committee. It was pretty.
Absolutely.
If anybody in the committee wants to play with any of the dolls too, then.
Not yet. You can't offer that yet. We have another bill to hear.
Knowing my history, I need to say no, thank you.
Yes, we'll pull the line there.
Thank you. And all kidding aside, Mr. Shaw, it really does help to see some visual representation, some actual examples. I appreciate that.
Representative Barry.
So I vote to increase it for animation. In another world, my aunt worked for Will Vinton Studios, did the Noid, did the Raisins and whatnot here. Laura Conheim. Did those and worked on those back in the day. So we just love the animation piece, and I'm glad they did bring it. That's fantastic.
Thank you very much. Thank you all very much. We have one more person, last but certainly not least, Charlie Carlson.
Kids, they like those movies. That's awesome. Coraline, that was from here. Coraline, did you see that?
Yeah.
Oh, that was really a great movie.
Mr. Carlson, I would have called you up before, but as you see, we only have three seats, so you get to be our big finish on the bill for today.
Thanks. I thought I'd come up with Nathaniel. Representative Reed, Vice Chair Vince, members of the committee, my name is Charles Carlson. I'm the IATSC union rep for the technicians that work behind the camera on film and television productions. I wasn't expecting to be here today. I'm actually working on film today. I have six people to put on moss on trees, by the way.
I know. You guys want to put moss on trees. More moss.
What I've seen with this OPIF is the difference between when we have money and when we don't. Well, I have members that call me for help for unemployment versus when we have money, they're calling me because they're buying houses and they need help getting the loans. And we have gotten to the point now where they're getting the loans. They're recognizing that there's enough employment, it's steady enough, that these people are actually qualifying for houses now. Whereas before, it was a hit and miss whether they were working or not. My members make, on Grimm, they make $70,000 a year on the full-time people. They make enough health insurance for 2 years when they work for 10 months. They have health insurance paid for 2 years, and they have retirement benefits on top of that. I'm here just to answer questions about numbers or employment or what a gaffer is or anything else you get.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Great. Questions? I don't see any. We appreciate your testimony. And we are at the end of our list on people who are here to testify on House Bill 2267. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today? Don't see any. So, colleagues, we have some amendments to consider, as you heard, but I expect we will return to this this bill before too long. So with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2267 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2453. Given that we don't have Troy here for a moment, let's ask Representative Berger to come up along with Jim Witte, if you're back there. And we have a couple other people who will be joining. I think Senator Starr is on his way. So, Representative Berger, if you want to get us started, we'll hear from those others. And I see you back there, Councilor Dirksen. I haven't forgotten about you either.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20. Under discussion is House Bill 2453. I see members of the Rough Tough Committee, and I see folks who don't know what Rough Tough stands for in front of us. It is the Road User Tax First Task Force Committee. And for those who are not familiar, it speaks to the fact that our roadways are paid for by gasoline taxes, and gasoline taxes have been traditionally a very good stand-in for how many miles you drive. If you drive a lot of miles, you need a lot of gasoline and you pay taxes accordingly. That dynamic is changing, and there's no question this is a global issue, and it is under sort of scrutiny across a lot of jurisdictions. And Oregon, with its unique sort of set of tax policies, is one of the leaders in trying to address this fact that as we increase gas mileage, we decrease the amount of money that comes in on a sort of per mile basis to maintain our roads and highways. So the Road User Task Force has been addressing how this might be changed in a forward-looking way. And last session we had a bill that was before the Revenue Committee regarding how to impose a fee on electric vehicles that would be a stand-in for the gases that they do not use, the taxes they do not use because they don't buy gas. There was much discussion at the time of the various ways you could get at that. The bill did not get out of the House, but the Road User Task Force has gone back and looked at this issue again, and before you is some better thinking on that issue. What is different, this particular bill, is a number of things. The most significant is it isn't about electric vehicles anymore, because it was seen as we were picking on the electric vehicles when really it's high mileage vehicles that are the issue. It isn't whether they're electric or not, it's that they have such high mileage values that they aren't paying their share of the miles that they drive. So this bill talks about high mileage and it defines it in a certain way. The other thing that this bill does is give a couple of options to the folks that might have such a vehicle to either pay in a flat rate or to pay on a mileage basis. The numbers, the flat rate numbers and the mileage basis are blank in the bill. These are policy decisions for us as policymakers, so the bill doesn't specify, but there's plenty of data on, you know, what would you get if, or what would you not get if, or where those numbers might be. The only other comment I'm going to make is that this fall, I was part of a little experiment where I got to plug a little gizmo into my car and got to compare how many miles I rode and how much gas I paid, and I will tell you that, and I don't think Mr. Witte's going to like my comments here, it was both as guaranteed, easy, painless, flawless, stuck the gizmo in, worked perfectly, didn't interrupt my life at all. But I will tell you, it's like the difference between our property taxes and a sales tax. When you pay a sales tax at the pump, you don't notice that you're paying for your... but when you get a statement every month, boy, you really look at that thing and you notice. And it had that interesting impact of, gee, just how many miles did I go and just how much gas tax would I have paid? And and how did this all work out? So in that sense, it is been a kind of an interesting journey. Oregon, I will emphasize that Oregon is leading literally the world in this effort. They are all watching sort of what is going on because it is recognized that going forward, gas taxes will not be the stand-in for mileage that it has sort of been in the past. And we need to be looking at other ways to sort of look at this issue. So with that, I commend this bill to you, and thank you very much for your attention to it.
Thank you. Let's ask if Representative Berger has, if we have any questions for her, then we can let her go. She may have other obligations, and Senator Starr is patiently waiting in the back, too. Any questions for Representative Berger?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Starr, do you want to join us? I know you've got a number of places to be as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Senator Bruce Starr. I have the distinct privilege of representing Western Washington County in the Oregon Senate, here to testify in favor of House Bill 2453, and I appreciate the opportunity to do that. I am not going to go into any great depth other than to say this is about fairness. It's about ensuring that folks that today are paying very little or no road use tax, highway tax for use of our highways. We have historically, traditionally been a user fee-based system, and that's what the gas tax used to be when virtually all the fleet of vehicles were paying basically the same amount of gas tax based on their miles per gallon usage. Today, the world's changed. Again, nobody should be able to drive on our roads for free, and we should have some semblance of fairness as it relates to folks paying for their use of the system. This bill gets us down that road, and I appreciate the work of the Road User Fee Task Force, which is a task force that I had something to do with getting started. So I appreciate the work of Mr. Witte and all the others that have, over the last couple of years, spent a lot more time on this particular bill and in that task force than I have. But I do take ownership in helping to get it started. So with that, I commend the work of the task force and this bill to you, and look forward to receiving it on the Senate side at some point here in the near future. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for Senator Starr? Don't see any.
Thank you
very much. And I should note before we turn it over to the Commissioner and Mr. Witte that this bill does have a subsequent referral both to, if I'm reading this right, Troy, we did this in error last time, to Revenue and to Ways and Means. So this is the beginning of a journey for this bill. Please.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is James Witte, and I just want to start with introducing Mary Olson. She should be the first one to go here. She is Transportation Commissioner for Oregon. She is also she's been on the Road User Fee Task Force for 2 years, and she's now the chairman of the Road User Fee Task Force. She also is a participant in the pilot project, and she also has a real job, too.
Very good. If you want to get us started. I didn't want to presume the correct order, so please go ahead.
Thank you. Again, my name is Mary Olson. And I was one of 34 participants in phase one of the Road User Task Force pilot program. And I guess I just want to spend a couple of minutes here talking about my experience and then be available for questions about the pilot program itself if you have any. There are five options that were available for calculating the road user tax. I chose the most sophisticated one. It was called the Advanced Program that had a GPS component to it. I did that specifically because I wanted to test out whether or not I would be charged if I drove on private roads, and I had an opportunity to do that on several occasions so I could check it out. I'm happy to report that it was outrageously accurate. It was a non-event. Representative Berger. It was non-evasive. I didn't pay any attention to it. And except for the fact that Jim Witte owes me $2.69 that I'm going to collect here. There isn't a whole lot more to tell. The good news is that on a national scale, we are getting recognized for our proactive stance on this issue. It is a national issue. Everyone's going to have to deal with it. We're all in the same boat. I was personally interviewed by NPR, King Television in Seattle, and the Atlantic Magazine, all of which ran stories on Oregon's progressive stance on this issue and what we're doing. So just as Oregon was the first state to invoke the sales tax, we will no doubt be the leader in evoking the second generation of collecting a user fee for our transportation system.
Very good.
Jim?
And at long last, Mr. Witte, I would love to have a sort of a summary of what the bill does, because I cut... Okay. I cut Troy off when he was off helping to gather up the senator. So,
yes,
please.
Mr. Chair, there's no point in going into the great arguments we're already made, so I don't have to make them. The bill establishes something called a road usage charge for vehicles that are rated at 55 miles per gallon and above. For the 2015 model year and beyond, beginning on July 1, 2015. All other vehicles would stay on the gas tax. It's important to remember that. The rest of them stay on the gas tax. There's no change there. People that would be in the system would have a fuel tax refund or offset. So nobody would pay both. You'd be on the road usage charge or on the gas tax, but nobody's paying both. ODOT would develop the methods of reporting, and we had four of them tested in the pilot. Indeed, we had a fifth option called flat rate, which was available in the pilot too, and somebody actually selected the flat rate. The methods in the pilot were pretty simple. They were there was a GPS option, but there also was a non-GPS option. So people could just report all their miles driven. And then there was one that was kind of a hybrid. It was a non-GPS option, but if you drove out of state and you wanted to exclude those miles, you could have an app on your smartphone that would then pair with that other device, and so you could exclude those miles. But these options were what's available now. We did an RFP. That's what was available in the marketplace. And the intention is, with this open system idea, which is another element in the bill, is the marketplace will then know what the standards are for supplying a mileage reporting device, and they will simply supply them. There won't be a government-selected technology. We learned from the original pilot, that doesn't work. People don't like the government to pick the box. Then what does the box do? So better to have the marketplace provide the technologies if people want to choose technologies, and then they'll be happy with the provider and the technologies they chose. So there is a flat rate alternative. The flat rate alternative is based on a maximum number of miles driven for people that want to buy out of the system. In the bill, it was set at 35,000 miles driven. Again, we don't have a rate, so we don't have a number there. But that was the number chosen. Like I said, somebody actually chose that in the pilot. And the rate in the pilot was essentially a cent and a half per mile. The bill also says that motorists will have choices. We're not going to just give them one. They'll be able to select from choices. There's also private sector involvement with tax processing and technology providing in the bill. And the most important provision probably is protection of personally identifiable information, which the last time we were here with a bill that Representative Berger talked about, they did not have that provision. Now we have that provision in the bill, and it's section 9. It's a very important section, I think. The key issue will be what should the rate be? And the task force really couldn't agree on the rate. And they decided, well, why should we fight our way through this? We should let the legislature decide, because they're going to decide it anyway. So they left the rate blank. I can't say that this committee will be the committee that does that. You know, that's up to the chairman and the committee to decide. Certainly the revenue committee will weigh in on the rate.
I was going to say, Mr. Whitty, even if we decide that we want to decide, there are two other committees.
So that's, in a rudimentary fashion, what the bill does. There's some charts and graphs in the back part of my testimony that I think are rather interesting. You can see that fuel consumption is down. And normally you'd expect that in a recession for fuel consumption to go down. And that's what ODOT's experienced for decades. You know, bad economy, fuel consumption goes down. But then something interesting happened. The economy started to return a little bit in 2009, and the fuels consumed went up. And then 2 years later, the last 2 years, it's gone down and down. So something's going on there. The marketplace is changing. The nature of what people drive is changing. Then you look at the red chart here, this one here. That's from the University of Michigan. It's been tracking what's happening with new vehicle fleets in the last 5 years. And as you see, there's been quite a rise. We're stuck at 20 miles per gallon with new vehicles for about two decades. And then all of a sudden, in 2007, we start rising. And we're rising steadily, as you can see. So something's going on, and it's probably best if we get ahead of it. And that's why the task force put together this bill, and that's why ODOT supports House Bill 2453.
Thank you, sir. I imagine there are some questions. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. when we heard this a couple of years ago, some of you will be aware that I was completely on board with the need to do this and with accepting the assumptions and the analysis about fuel sales and fuel efficiency and the need for revenue, but that I was pretty troubled about some technology issues. What kind of technology is Oregon going to be developing? What were we adopting? What were we going to be paying for it? And it seemed like we were already committed to a particular solution. I had several in-depth discussions with Mr. Whitty, and I want to express my appreciation for your listening carefully to some of the things that I was expressing doubts about. I'm pleased that in Section 6 of this bill, it's acknowledging some of these important issues with regard to recording and reporting, the data accuracy, privacy, security, and audit compliance. In the next paragraph, it talks about at least one method has to be not related to location technology. It's talking about open system standards. And even very specifically, this was perhaps because of my request, collaborating with state agencies to integrate information systems currently in use or planned for future use, because we've seen way too often agencies adopting and designing their own solutions, and then we find out later nothing talks to each other, and we have to then create very costly ways of letting the systems communicate with each other, or just abandon it and admit that we're collecting data twice. And that's not such a good idea either. So on the one hand, I'm really glad to see all of this in Section 6. On the other hand, I'm still going to be watching very carefully to see what technology we think we're developing, how much we think we're going to have to spend on it. Because being a beta test site is a pretty darned expensive thing. And I also hope that the department is already in discussion with the main technology contact person in the legislative fiscal office, because that person also ends up being involved in reviewing the business case for these proposals that come through us and that end up in Ways and Means.
One of the advantages of having a member of the Ways and Means Committee here, a veteran member at that. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Representative Lively?
Well, I'd like to understand a little bit the relationship of this proposal as it relates to one of the things you show in here is the diminishing revenue from the gas tax. So how this proposal relates to what projections we have going forward, the funds we're going to have in total, because if the gas tax itself continues to go down, and while this will start raising more revenue, there's not that significant number of vehicles yet. I'm still concerned about the next decade or whatever it is from a standpoint of how we're going to fund projects.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lively, this is all about economic projections now. And one thing I've learned on trying to do exactly what you're talking about is that no two economists agree. And so it's very hard to actually answer your question with any kind of authority. It has to do with to what extent will people move to these really high fuel efficient vehicles. It's just an unknown. At some point, if this system is up and going, it could be looked at for a lower level, below 55, and that may do more for the revenue system. But that's something for the legislature to decide at a later date. At this point, I think Senator Starr is correct. It's a bit of a fairness issue because you have vehicles that aren't paying anything for the road use, and they're still on the roads and beating it up and clogging it up, and then some that are still paying just a little bit of revenue. So that's what the task force wants to do, is start with that group and then see how we do. This is still a system that hasn't been put in place yet. And so it needs to be, you know, we've got to hit the mark before anybody's going to look at changing the existing gas tax system for more and more folks.
Quick follow-up, please.
So there, at this point, there's not a, we haven't looked at what kind of the ongoing needs are from a standpoint of the gas tax and said we think this could fill that percentage of it. This is just, at this point, we're just trying to get the program started.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Lively, you know, we have a financial and economic model we built to determine these issues. And sure, I've plugged in various numbers into that to see what would happen.
Sure.
And I'd be happy. I mean, I don't know. This isn't something that the committee would want to do, but if any one of you wants to go through that with me, I'm happy to show you what happens when you plug numbers in. Revenues go up. You bet they do. If the number comes down, if the eligibility number comes down.
Representative Gorsuch.
And going back to what was being discussed in terms of the billing, is there a model currently in place, or is that still evolving in terms of how that would work and how often?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, we learned a lot in the pilot on that. Mm-hmm. The billings were very small. Mm-hmm. The monthly billings for a lot of people were small. And so what we learned is you don't want to have a monthly billing in most right. cases. It might be a few cases, but for the most part, you'll add them up quarterly or semi-annually or annually. And there's actually a section on in the bill on this that talks about how you'll determine reporting periods. It's Section 8.
Oh, okay. I just didn't see it when I looked through.
Representative Gorsuch,
yes.
The third-party providers that participated in this did provide monthly billings, and obviously they can adjust that
right.
to be less frequent. But the billing process was part of the pilot and was up and working.
Quick follow-up. The second question that I have for you is, what's do we know the fiscal impact on the state to do this processing then?
Chair Reed, Representative Gorsuch, we have submitted a fiscal impact statement to the legislature. Now we're starting up a new tax system from scratch.
Right.
So it's, I think, the first biennium. It's estimated at about $3 million to do this. Now we're not, and the department is not adding anybody. We're using the existing staff, such as me and some other people that have worked on the pilot, and then we'll have to redeploy other ODOT employees to start this system. So when I say $3 million, that takes into account people that already exist at ODOT.
Right.
They'll be redeployed. It is not an additional set of staff to do this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm cognizant of the fact that we have several people to testify yet. We want to get through that, Representative Gordy.
It was just dealing with his question about the billing.
Okay. Did you want to?
And I'm part of the pilot project, and every month they go through, and it's a nice bill. We get it online, and it goes through and says how many miles you drove, and they deduct the ones that were out of state. How they know that, I don't know. And so it came up to an amount of money, and then they backed out what the gas tax would be, assuming that I'd use X amount of gallons of gas. And it was literally a wash what I would pay on the road user fee and what I would pay, you know, after they backed out the gas tax was the same amount of money. Comes online, you just go through and put your credit card in. And but Mr. Woody is right. It was like $8. So doing that every month seemed rather low. Every quarter seemed to be a good idea.
Thank you, Representative Cameron.
Yeah, about three questions, Mr. Chair. And maybe somebody else will answer them if you can't. One, I've heard about private roads. They're excluded. Mm-hmm. Out of state? Mm-hmm. About out of state vehicles in Oregon?
Ah.
And the last question is it doesn't apply until a 2015 model? So if I have an electric car today downstairs, I'm not going to pay ever any taxes for that car?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, currently that's the way the bill is drafted.
Pardon me?
Currently that is the way the bill is drafted, yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Did you want to address the out-of-state cars in Oregon, please?
Yes. This pilot project did not address out-of-state drivers coming into the state. It was only dealing with Oregonians. And that is something that the task force recognized they got to get to at some point. What do you do with out-of-state drivers? What we did is start to work with some neighboring states, Washington and Nevada, which selected their own participants and came into our pilot. So that's the beginning of working together with other states to figure that issue out. If you pass this bill, probably not a lot to lose because electric cars and plug-in hybrids either pay no gas tax now or very little, and they do the same thing if this bill passes. So you're not losing a lot. It's just something we have to watch for and correct in the future that out-of-state drivers should pay for use of the roads in Oregon.
One last question just made me think of, what about the federal tax?
Representative Reed, Chair Reed, Representative Cameron, we could not touch the federal tax because it's, it's federal law. So at some point, though, however, the feds may want to piggyback on the Oregon system, just like they did way back in the, I think it was early 30s when they piggybacked on the Oregon gas tax. So
it's another example of us leading the rest of the state, or the rest of the country, figuring out how to deal with it. So appreciate it. We have a number of other people. Please stick around. We may have additional questions for Representative Parrish.
I just have a question about scale in terms of collection. I mean, so you bill people go online and make a payment? Is that the thought? Because I guess one of the questions, the follow-up to that is that, you know, there was an article this week about Oregon's owed more than $3 billion in assorted money. And I just wonder how you really realistically, if this scales, how you really collect that. If we got $3 billion we left on the table for income tax, now we're talking about potentially a vehicle mile tax. I just don't see where the scale comes in on the collection part.
Chairman Reed, Representative Parrish, the scale issue is important. We'll start out small with the first car that's registered in 2015. This is a learning process. So I can't say we've got everything nailed. We have to get the business case down. There's no question about that. We had an original pilot back in 2006 and 2007 that did the collection at the fuel pump, which worked pretty darn well. But people wanted to see how it would work with an account, with billing monthly. So we proved that. Maybe that we'll review or revisit the collection at the fuel pump as an option. Because there'll be people that want to pay on a transaction basis as opposed to a monthly or annual billing basis. And so this whole new system is about giving people options so they can find options that they prefer. But we'll also have to make sure that they actually do pay. So if you're correct, the business case is something we'll develop after the bill passes.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, we'll start down our list now. Paul Cosgrove, Craig Dirksen, please, and Craig Campbell. Councilman, it's good to see you here in a new role, I think maybe for the first time. We appreciate your patience.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Please, if you'd like to go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to come and speak on this issue today. My name is Craig Dirksen. I'm a Metro Councilor. I have the honor of representing District 3, which goes from Central Beaverton south through Wilsonville. And as such, I am here today to express the council's support for this bill. But in addition to that, before January, I was the mayor of Tigard for 8 years. And as mayor of Tigard, I sat on the task force representing the League of Oregon Cities. And I would just want to encourage the committee to look upon this bill with favor and move it forward through the process. As a member of the task force, I would draw the committee's attention to the two pilot programs that have been mentioned, successfully completed. This is no longer a theoretical proposal. This is something that has been tested, and it can be implemented. And encourage that the time is now for that to take place. In the short term, this bill addresses a growing segment of the vehicle fleet that isn't paying its fair share. I actually would rather say it, they're failing to pay enough revenue to support the highway system of the state of Oregon and consider it in that regard. And that area is only going to grow. And I say that as the owner of a plug-in electric vehicle myself. And in the longer term, this is a positive effort and direction for the state to take, and it's our best path forward for to create a stable road funding system in Oregon. And I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Let's hear from the panel first, and then we'll ask your questions. Mr. Cosgrove.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. Paul Cosgrove representing the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. The Alliance's members include all the American manufacturers, most of the Europeans, and a good number of the Asians as well. So lots of brands from Porsche to Chevrolet are in the membership of the Alliance. We have concerns about the bill. For those of you who were here last session, we discussed some of those concerns, but I would like to highlight them briefly. One is, although the bill no longer says it is targeted at electric vehicles, the per mile limit, 55 miles per gallon or its equivalent that's in the bill was very specifically picked so that it only will affect at this point electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids. And the reason that's of concern to us is those are vehicles that we as an industry are required by law to sell. And if our state adopts what California just did, and in fact we're on track to do so, we will be required to sell a lot more of them. And frankly, if you talk to your local car dealer, you'll find that they're not so easy to sell. And that's partly because of the nature of our state. Our state, with a few exceptions, is primarily rural with long driving distances. And these are vehicles that are not terribly well suited to that kind of lifestyle. So our concern is to protect the market that we need to try to grow. Our second concern has to do with the fact that we think there's a better way to get to the joint goal of a more sustainable financial system for the roads. We have begun work as an industry and as an association with legislators. A legislator from this state is amongst that. We expect there are others. It'll be done under the auspices, we believe, of NCSL, looking at can we move into a non-propulsion specific set of pilots across the country using some available federal funding. The real problem with this kind of a system isn't is it better or will it work? It is, will the consumer accept it? And the fact is, there is a good deal of evidence. Representative Berger, I think, said it well. One of the issues in terms of it's different. It's different, and it's a tax that comes in a bill rather than one that you sort of see but don't really see at the pump. And we have to, as a society, be able to find a way to move consumers to be accepting of this kind of a process, we think, if it's going to be successful. You will get a very small sample of even Oregon consumers if it is limited to 55 miles a gallon or more. There's a chart that the department has. I think there are now a total of 1,200 of those cars registered in the state from the beginning of time. And they're not your average drivers, and they're not statewide, and they're not predominantly predominantly rural or small town. So we think there's a better way, which is to do a non-propulsion specific kind of pilot and do it across the country in conjunction with other states. And then my last point is, this really doesn't deal with the fairness issue terribly well in that it loses money. It loses money for the road fund. Mr. Witte mentioned the $3 million. That's a lot larger than the estimate was last biennium, which was, I believe, one or one and a half to do startup. And last biennium, it was projected to lose money for the road fund for at least the first three biennia before it broke even. And it's partly because, whether you like it or not, the gas tax is highly efficient to collect. It doesn't cost the state much to collect gas tax. It's an efficient, well-working machine. This kind of system is a lot less efficient, and the cost per dollar tax collected is much higher. So those are our concerns. As I say, we think there is a better way, and it's the way working with legislators from across the country to gain a system that has enough people participating that it overcomes some of that consumer resistance that we see and that isn't targeted specifically at electric vehicles. Happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, sir. Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of AAA in support of House Bill 2453. I'm also a member of the task force and was part of the pilot project. I chose to do the full meal deal with the GPS and the whole thing. The nice thing about it was once I found where to plug it in, I plugged it in and I got to forget about it for about 3 months. Apparently, my car has about the average miles per gallon of the state fleet, as my total cost for that period above the gas tax, which I was paying, was about $2.30. So this is a first step to what needs to be a very long deliberative process, because what Mr. Cosgrove said is effectively correct, and that is you have to make sure that consumers are willing to accept a change to this new form of taxation. That's not going to be easy. We represent 750,000 members in the state of Oregon. Some of them are rather concerned about somebody putting something in their car that tracks where they go, and we have to be cognizant of that. So one of the things that we support about this bill is it has to provide options for those who are going to be moving to the new tax system so that they can adopt a method that doesn't track where they go. In fact, we support language in the bill that would prevent the state from providing a device that would provide GPS. If the private sector wanted to provide that, that would be an option for somebody who wanted to go with a private company to do that. The problem is that ultimately this really is about ultimately getting a tax system that can replace the deteriorating gas tax and at the same time provide a level of fairness that the current system doesn't provide. Because with our members, you have folks who are driving around in pickup trucks that are paying far more than their fair share, and you have folks that are in hybrids or electric vehicles that are paying nothing to the road system. That is not to discredit their reason for driving those sorts of vehicles. There are good reasons for the environment and other things that people have chosen to adopt those vehicles, but the tax system should not be the way that we either reward or condemn a person's practice and what kind of vehicle they choose. We believe that the rate should be set according to the cost allocation study that is done in Oregon every 2 years. Essentially what that does is that takes all of the costs that we pay for in the state for our road maintenance, preservation, and expansion, and we assess that and we split it up between cars and trucks so that everyone is paying their fair share. Very easy to get a rate per mile from that to determine what is every vehicle's fair share to do that. I should point out that one of the reasons why we're actively involved in this discussion is because a little over 13 years ago, when we told the trucking industry that we couldn't get rid of the weight mile tax, we basically said, but since we recognize that to be the fairest tax, we're going to work to make sure that Oregon is amongst the first to adopt that for vehicles as well. But it really is about overcoming the general fear of the public when you make that sort of a transition. But we have to, for the good of the highway fund in the long term, find a way to adopt a tax system like this one that reflects actual use and the costs that are imposed on the system. And so that's one of the reasons why we strongly support moving in this direction. But again, we have to be deliberative about it, and we have to be careful about how we do it so we don't create a shock that has people rebelling against whatever new system we put in place. With that, I can answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Representative Cameron.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe somebody who served on the committee can answer this. Did anybody do an analysis of, especially on these all-electric cars that are plugging in, what's the public purpose charge or public service charge on the electricity that they're using, and where is that tax going? Was there any analysis done to say, well, why don't we grab some of that and put it towards the road fund since they're paying the tax to charge the car?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I'll take a quick shot at it. Because the cost that's paid, where they're charged, because there are charging stations where those who are recharging their vehicles are not charged, somebody is still paying for the electricity, but it is not specific to just car users. That that assessment is paid by everyone who pays electricity. So you'd have to tease out the specifics about how much energy was being purchased for the purposes of recharging vehicles. But I don't recall there being ever discussion about that in the Road User Fee Task Force.
I'll add to that a little bit. In the last session, we had a bill that would have allowed, we didn't move it forward, but would have allowed the state to offer electricity for vehicle charging for free, and the reason to consider that was that the administrative tasks associated with tracking it exceeded the cost of the electricity that was actually used. So I don't know the specific numbers, but they may not work out to be effective to track it. So certainly something we can follow up on. Other
questions? Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
I could share some of my experience, recent experience, sure, as exists now. For commercial chargers, typically the part of the cost goes to the vendor for the charging unit itself. Most of the units that I've experienced with are on the grounds of local jurisdictions where local government agencies have provided them, and a portion of that cost of the money also goes to that local agency. The cost right now to charge on a commercial unit is typically $1 or $1.50 an hour, which is much in excess. The actual amount of electricity you're using is probably more on the range of 30 cents in an hour. And so that profit goes, I believe, in most cases at least, equally to the vendor of the unit and to the jurisdiction on whose grounds it sits.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Right. Just kind of a follow-up to the same question. Have you run a per mile equivalent cost on your electric car for the electricity as compared to the safe gasoline?
I haven't done the exact comparison to that extent, but my car will go approximately 35 miles on a charge before it switches over to its gasoline engine. That would equate to about a gallon of gasoline. The cost to charge that on my home unit, because I have a unit at home, is about 65 cents.
Thank you. Next up.
Mr. Chair.
Yes?
Would it be possible for me to address one of Mr. Cosgrove's concerns?
Sure.
The first one with regard to incentivizing people to purchase electric automobiles. And my view of that is as was pointed out by Representative Cameron earlier, is that because the implementation of this would be delayed, and the way that the bill is written would be that vehicles purchased before the bill is implemented would be exempt. This would actually create a short-term, very strong incentive to purchase high-mileage vehicles before the law was to be enacted. This would create a great kickstart incentive for the industry for high-mileage vehicles, and one that wouldn't require any other kind of appropriation or program by the state.
Good point.
Mr. Chair, if I may. There's nothing in this bill that says we can't go backwards and bring them all in later.
Oh, certainly.
Mr. Chair, if I may have a counterpoint, and I'll make it very quick. The rate at the pilot, which was also the rate in the last biennium's bill at 1.56 cents a mile, and recall when you register a new car, you charge 4 years of registration. If my math is correct, there would be a charge for a purchaser of a new electric vehicle when this became implemented of $2,184 when they bought it. That's the kind of problem that we see in terms of having this kind of a charge on just electric vehicles. That's a pretty big disincentive. So that's the concern.
Thank you. Next up.
Wait, Mr. Chair. Yeah, may I, please?
Go ahead.
All right. Would you repeat that number and where you got that number for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, the rate that they charged in the pilot of 1.56 cents per mile, and the figure in the bill where you have a flat fee option and it's based on 35,000 miles. And then you do that times four, because when you do a new car, you pay the first 4 years of registration all at one lump sum. So it's 4 years times 1.56 cents per mile times 35,000 is $2,184, if my math is correct. I think it's correct. It's close to correct.
However, that would be if that person chose that option as opposed to any of the other options that would be available.
And we think some people will, because of the concerns that have been expressed about...
Perhaps so. I'm just making the point that that's one of the options, not the only one.
Correct.
I could rip some cameras.
Just so I clarify, because I haven't bought a new car lately. So when I buy a new car, I pay a registration for 4 years, not 2 years?
Correct. And when you renew, it's in just 2 years.
Okay. Follow up, if I may.
Yes.
But that doesn't... The registration of that car... electric car, even if I put wine plates on it, is the same as my gas car, correct? So my registration fee at the time I buy the car for 4 years is only the registration fee, not the gas tax.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, yes, although if you chose the lump sum, it would be collected at registration. That's my understanding of how that would work. So it would be done, you would have your regular registration that everybody pays, and then you would have this other fee.
I think the point he's making is that when you buy a gas car and you pay the four-year registration, what you are not paying is the gas tax that you're then paying every time you're buying gas over the subsequent 4 years. Did I get that right?
Correct, but I don't see in the bill where I have to pay 4 years. If I take the lump sum, I didn't see in the bill where I have to pay the 4 years up front when I buy a new car.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron,
that was
my understanding of how the pilot was intended to work if it was implemented in this bill. There was discussion of that. Now, it could be changed,
that.
Obviously,
yes, we certainly
but that's
need to
my
clarify
understanding.
That.
We need to clarify that.
That's fine. Thank you very much.
Thank Mr.
you.
Chair, actually, I believe the intent was that you would pay your an annual amount for the lump sum for that year that you're operating and not 4 years in advance.
The good news is that Troy is taking careful notes, and we will make sure we get that clarified explicitly before we go any further with the bill. Next up, Becky Strauss, Craig Honeyman, and Mike Johnson, please.
Go ahead. I think we're racing against the clock.
We are.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, members of the committee. Becky Strauss on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to come testify and provide some comments and really raise a few concerns. The civil liberties interest here for us is to ensure that any proposal from the Road User Fee Task Force that does move forward does not do so at the cost of privacy rights of the users. I know that a lot of work has been done in the interim and since the first proposal came forward to try to address some of those privacy issues, and I do think that what's come forward has come a long way. I just want to take a few minutes to raise a couple additional concerns, see if we can work with the proponents and tighten that up a little.
How about 2 minutes?
2 minutes. I can try to even do
Thank
less.
You. Thank you. The
first kind of clump of concern is I'm kind of calling it a category of true choice for drivers. So I'm thinking of that section 4(1) is talking about the opt-out for the flat annual fee. The concern is that the 35,000 miles seems much higher than probably what someone would drive annually. And so if a person is provided an option to opt out of the GPS location tracking option, for example, we would want to make sure that they're not incentivized not to do so. It seems to be then a false choice. And the second piece in regard to Section 6 that Representative Nathanson had raised earlier, I was just hoping for some clarification. I think this makes sense to me, but what it looks like is happening is that there's the flat tax option, and then in addition to the flat tax option, in statute there is always a requirement that there be something in addition to the location tracking option, so that at the minimum there would be three options. I know the pilot program had five options. Don't want to confuse things. I think that all makes sense, but I think part of the confusion is much of the bill is leaving this to the department rulemaking, which I have heard some of the advantages from Mr. Witte. I think there are some disadvantages in terms of leaving those sidebars to the flexibility of rulemaking. So I'll stop there, and then what I really want to focus in on is Section 9, which is dealing with collection and disclosure of personally identifiable information from the user. I think that hopefully there's some movement that can be done around, it seems that there's a lot of data points being collected, from credit card number to driver license number to number of miles traveled, and their authority to be disclosed to a great number of parties, including employees of the department, contractors for the system, a long list that I won't go through listing, but I think if we can try to do a better job of associating the data point that's actually needed for that particular user or person who's receiving the information, so that we're not compiling a great number of data points in one place that really aren't needed for all the users. And then along that line, I'm confused by Section 9, Sub 3E, in reference to law enforcement agencies having access to the information. I think I'm not exactly sure what type of law enforcement agency would be enforcing this law. And then along with that, we would argue strongly that any law enforcement agency that's accessing location information about an innocent person should have probable cause to believe that it's going to produce evidence of a crime. And then finally, I hope that I might work with the proponents to put in a structure in regard to destruction of the information when it's no longer needed. I think we do want to have the ability to retain the information, so it's to the certain extent that we collect the accurate tax that's owed. So maybe there would be some way for the user to retain a hard copy of their record and the department destroys the personally identifiable information. I'm not sure, but I'm hoping we can come up with some ideas along those lines. And that's all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Honeyman.
Representative Reed, members of the committee, I'm Craig Honeyman, Legislative Director, League of Oregon Cities. We represent all 242 cities in the state. I will be brief and summarize my prepared comments, which have been distributed to you. First thing I want to do, however, though, is thank Mayor Dirksen, who served on the Rough Tough Task Force, which has brought you this legislation on behalf of the League, as he previously indicated. So I appear today in support of House Bill 2453, and the reason is very simple. Cities don't have enough money today to manage their streets. In a study that the League did about a year ago, we found that cities which own and manage 22,500 lane miles of streets face an annual funding gap of approximately $190 million in the aggregate, a big number. And while the Jobs and Transportation Act of 2009 helped considerably, the gap is still large, and I don't have to tell you that the deferral of city road maintenance is resulting in additional deterioration and increased repair costs, and frankly, it's leading to an investment in infrastructure that's being wasted. So I will just move on and conclude by saying that although there has been some concern registered that maybe this legislation would provide a disincentive to the adaptation of this new technology, of new auto technology, we believe that the issue is one of equity. High mileage cars need to pay their fair share. We don't believe that this would create an adverse impact. In fact, we would suggest to you that now is the time to implement this kind of vehicle miles traveled fee as we just get started with this new technology. So time for Oregon and you as members of the committee to become innovative again. The state of Oregon was the first in the nation to implement a gas tax, and I believe that it's time for us to step up again and be innovative, as I said, and assure the sustainability of our surface transportation system going forward. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Johnson.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Johnson. I am an employee of Oregon Department of Transportation, a member of SEIU, OPEU, Local 503, and an Oregon taxpayer. I am, as a member of the union, I am here to testify on House Bill 2453. We appreciate all of the work that has gone into developing a sustainable option to generate funds to maintain Oregon's transportation infrastructure. The specific piece that I would like to address today has to do with the collection of the road usage charge that would generate from House Bill 2453. During the pilot, the task force contracted with a Canadian company to collect the charges online. The bill allows for ODOT to determine by rule how the road usage charge will be collected. We urge the committee to amend the bill requiring ODOT to use internal divisions instead of paying a contractor to do this work. We would like to see ODOT incorporate the collection of this new charge within its existing structure. For example, the Department of Motor Vehicles collects fees online for thousands of Oregonians today. ODOT's Motor Carrier Division collects similar fee from commercial truck drivers. We believe Oregonians would be better served if the money was collected in Oregon, managed by ODOT, and all monies used to maintain the services ODOT provides. There has to be a better way than contracting out work to an out-of-state or out-of-country company. We urge the committee to require ODOT to do the work in-house instead of contracting it out. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We have four more people to testify. They are Marshall Koba, Ann Hannes, Peggy Woolsey, and then Rebecca Roth after those three.
Hi. For the record, my name is Ann Hannes. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. We believe this is an important step for long-term sustainable funding for roads for not just the state, but counties and cities as well. This is all part of a system of roads for funding. We also believe it's equitable. And the way to collect revenue is from high mileage vehicles. This is not just limited to electrical vehicles. It's important to note that by 2025, the federal government's requiring that vehicles attain 54.5 miles per gallon. So this is really something to be able to take the step now to have a long-term sustainable system. I do want to add that I was part of one of the guinea pigs in the pilot project, and even someone as mechanically challenged as me could figure out how to put in the little pack into the car, and it was basically seamless and easy to use. So I think that the system has now been vetted, tested, proven. It's ready to be, to go full bore, and we urge your support for this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed and committee members. My name is Peggy Woolsey. I'm with Tax Fairness Oregon. Our members have all agreed that they would support this bill. We believe it's important to have all people fairly supporting our road system and our infrastructure. I saw another bill introduced recently, House Bill 2277, which is proposes to charge a fee for studded tires that helps to repair our roads, and it makes it more fair that the people who are causing more damage would support the roads. I think that this does the same thing with high mileage vehicles. I think, again, we've got high mileage vehicles only are going to increase over the future, and it's not going to be just electric. I've been waiting for over 10 years for the promise of the fuel cell vehicles. So I'm a potential owner of a high mileage car, and when that time comes, I would like to be able to have this option. I do think that if the fees collected under this pilot program cannot support the need or don't fully fund what they should, perhaps more cents per mile might be charged, and that's something that I believe that can be tinkered with in the future.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Koba.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, members of the committee. I am Marshall Koba, this afternoon representing the American Council of Engineering Companies and our more than 110 member firms statewide. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2453. We have always advocated for innovative and significant investment in Oregon's infrastructure. Our members are intimately knowledgeable about the failing state of Oregon and America's infrastructure and transportation system. We understand and appreciate the need for a continued robust funding stream to maintain this infrastructure. To this end, we support House Bill 2453 and the implementation of a road usage charge for high efficient vehicles. In addition, we support Oregon's longstanding commitment to a policy of cost responsibility that ensures road users pay their fair share. Cost responsibility ensures that all vehicles, either cars or trucks, pay fairly to use the system, and we support this policy of fair and cost responsible taxation and believe that House Bill 2453 will bring more fairness to the users of highly efficient vehicles. We urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? I don't see any. Thank you very much. Our last person is Rebecca Roth, please. And Ms. Roth, as you sit down, I should tell you, you're the last person before these good people get to go home, so you'll understand.
Oh.
start looking a little restless.
Well, I'll try to make it good.
Thank you.
All right. I'm Rebecca Roth, and from Salem, Oregon, and chair and committee. I'm sorry, I have double vision. I can't read your names.
You did just fine.
I'm here because, it was interesting hearing everybody talk about fairness and choice, because I feel that there's not a lot of choice or fairness in the level of taxation that's being considered in Oregon in lots of bills. I talk to people that move away all the time. So anyway, that's another discussion. But I wanted to relay a little story that happened to me. I was out in the front there and reading that wonderful saying that's up on the wall in our Capitol that says, "In the souls of its citizens will be found the likeness of the state, which if they be unjust and tyrannical, then will it reflect their vices. But if they be lovers of righteousness, confident in their liberties, so will it be clean in its justice and bold in freedom." And that was said by Thomas Jefferson. And I hope you guys look at that and give it some consideration, because that's a wonderful saying. But when I went and asked who said that, I was told by the man out front there, that the tour leader, that it was said by Jefferson, but that he spoke out of both sides of his mouth.
Ms. Roth, I hate to interrupt, but I'm wondering if
this relates. It just, I have to get to the point, okay?
Please.
Thomas Jefferson owned slaves, and he never released any of them except five. But I told him, and this is what I want to tell you, Thomas Jefferson inherited his slaves, and they came with contracts that had been made by his father, because that's what you did. You lived beyond your means. And then you went to your creditors and you said, "I have X number of slaves. Let's make a contract, and they'll work X number of years so that they can work off my debts." And those slaves had to do that even if Thomas Jefferson inherited them. The fact that he was able to free five slaves means that those five slaves came out from under the contracts that had been made on their behalf by his father, and then he was also able to post bond for them for their behavior, because that's what you had to do under law at that time.
Ms. Roth, could you explain how this is related to the bill?
And ours, this is so interesting that today the legislature passed a new use of our money that's going to put us in contract using paper money that's being printed by the federal government, and we are obligated for that. We're the slaves that aren't being freed, and we have
need to come out from
always having these new contracts made for us. It's not in fairness that we're talking, it's in bondage that we're talking. The government needs to look at itself and stop spending money.
Thank you, Ms. Roth. We
the
appreciate
federal
your testimony.
Government money that's being printed
we're gonna need
right
to
now is
cut off your testimony just
thievery.
Because we've heard your points.
Thank
we
you very much for your time. I hope you will listen to Thomas Jefferson. He's worth listening to.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate the committee as well sticking around a little past our typical ending time. I knew you had it in you after our last couple of meetings. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2453 and remind you that we will have what I hope is an interesting discussion about infrastructure generally on Wednesday. We'll see you for that committee meeting. Thank you very much. Please adjourn.